Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk about You Can't Take It With You, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Tailspin, Something's Rotten, which is an industry reading, The Guys at Staten Island Shakespearean Theater, and Big, the musical at the York Theater Company. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Monday, October 13th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Michael Bortantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Bortantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, happy Columbus Day.
Yes, yeah. It is a happy Columbus Day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can only think of Jason Robert Brown's New World music that's related to Columbus. What else is related to Columbus?
Well, there was 1491, the musical. Meredith Wilson wrote that. You know, Columbus is mentioned in Trousers too. There's a wonderful sequence in William Finn's first musical with wonderful, wonderful music. Oh, I still remember that night in '78 when I first heard it, and how thrilled I was, virtually jumping in my seat, and I mean that. So there's a sequence about Columbus there. I also know that Let It Ride, a 1961 musical, has a song in which Columbus is an important component. Columbus got around.
There's the Gershwin song. Is it from a show? How long has this been going on?
I don't know if that's from a show.
That has a wonderful line about Columbus. Mm-hmm. And, what's the song, James, from...
They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, certainly.
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess Ira liked him.
she did.
James, what is the song from Songs from a New World that mentions Columbus Day?
I think it's actually called Christopher Columbus.
Oh, okay.
I could have totally made that up.
Oh, and it's also in. She keeps saying that in Little Women.
Yes, that's right. Christopher Columbus is her euphemism for the deity. Let's say that other people use. Good point. Yeah.
I totally made that up. I'm looking at Jason Robert Brown's website, opening the New World on the deck of a Spanish sailing ship, 1492. It doesn't explicitly say Christopher Columbus, but it definitely...
It may very well. Yeah, yeah.
So maybe it's in the music somewhere that it's a Christopher Columbus reference. But speaking of Jason Robert Brown...
Yes.
His newest foray onto Broadway is You Can't Take It With You. Which, did you guys know that? He wrote some incidental music for it?
I did notice that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Kidding.
No, he knocked that one out. So, Peter, Michael, and I got a chance to see You Can't Take It With You over at the Long Acre. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
The first time I ever saw this play was in the very late 60s, and it's funny to think that it really had a very late 60s philosophy about why work so hard, you know, don't worry, be happy, don't take your job seriously. And indeed, Grandpa Vanderhoff felt this at a reasonably young age and decided to just drop out of the rat race. And that's what he was going to do. And he taught his family to do that. And they just have lived happily ever after. Yeah, not much money. Oh, but honey, ain't we got fun? That's the real feeling behind this family. And there is one responsible, if you want to use that word, which I guess is antithetical to what Kaufman and Hart wrote, the responsible person. But anyway, Alice is the one who goes out and makes the living while everybody else has a wonderful time. The wife is writing plays. The husband, her father, is somebody who works with fireworks. There are boarders who come in. They don't seem to pay any money. They just seem to have – they come there. They stay. They leave when they die. And so it's a crazy household. Nobody worries that nobody's getting anywhere. And this was really a late 60s philosophy that many people had. However, of course, many of those people who held that philosophy certainly went to Wall Street and other such places and made a lot of money. And yet the play doesn't date because it does tie into our fantasies about how we wish we could live this way and not worry about societal pressures or making a living or anything like that. So because, you know, after all, when you die, you can't take it with you. So that's what the play does. James Earl Jones is playing the grandfather. He knows his lines. Yes, he does. But there is something very rote-ish about the performance. He plays it by rote. I mean, it's like, oh, I know my lines here. You know, there's something where he's circling around the role, but he hasn't quite landed on it yet. The way a bee goes around a flower and takes a while for it to land. In a way, that's the way James Earl Jones is coming across to me. But among the people in the family, the one I most admired was Annalee Ashford playing Essie, who wants to be a dancer, and she concentrates on that. And as her dancing teacher tells us, played by Reg Rogers, she stinks. However, you know, she's always dancing and she's concentrating on it. And it really is a very centered performance. Because the mother, played by Christine Nielsen, when you got a play like this, you have to have Christine Nielsen if you're doing it now, you know, because she really is wonderful at being batty. Because she's a playwright, she certainly invites an actress over the house, perhaps who will be interested in starring in her play. The actress is only interested in getting the next drink from them, and she is admirably played, as always, by Julie Halston. So she's terrific as well. Mark Lynn Baker is really quite nice as the father. Again, always, you know, all these people seem a little preoccupied, airy, and it's very nice. There's even room back then, you know, when the Russian nobility having fallen after the revolution, that these people make appearances as well, including the dance teacher, Boris Kolenkikov, and Elizabeth Ashley showing up at the end as the Grand Duchess Olga, who is now working as a cook, a short order cook. So, and in short order, she makes even more chaos of the house. Well, you have to have a conflict, don't you? Well, Alice is in love with the boss's son, and they're going to come over for dinner, and what's going to happen when they see these people? I will admit that the how they show up on the wrong night is a little clunky to me, the reason given, but the play is so delightful. This is about the 10th, 15th time I've seen it over the years, and this was the first time it really made me cry when speeches at the end talking about how you have to live life and not put your future on hold, not to mortgage your future, and just take the essence of things. The expression, wake up and smell the flowers, take time to smell the flowers, I guess I should say, hadn't really come into vogue yet, but that's what this play is saying, and it really moved me this time. Very pretty production, turntable set. The house has all the chaos that it needs to have to show that everybody's interested in everything and lands on nothing. So David Rockwell did a really nice job there. Strangely enough, James Earl Jones is the weak link, but not weak enough to sink it. Not at all. But at times when I thought, oh, he's too old, oh, he's phoning it in, the thing is he was always raring to go with that line that he had to say next. So it isn't quite that. There's just something about it that's just a tiny bit removed. So while I'm sure a lot of people are going to go to see him, I bet they come away being impressed by most everybody else.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, Peter, thank you for trying to explain that, because I noticed it too, and I would not have been able to explain it as well as you did. I noticed it in certain sections much more than others. For example, I thought that when Mr. Jones got to that final speech, he completely nailed it, and he had stopped doing that. It's not he doesn't stumble. It's just like it's almost like he's looking off into the distance somewhere while saying one line, trying to make sure he's got the next one right. Does that sound?
I can appreciate that. I'll take that. Yeah.
Yeah. But never stumbles. It's hard to, you'll have to kind of see it to to know what we're talking about. But still, even though that's absolutely, I think we both agree on that, he's just such a warm presence, and he does have many, many wonderful moments. So it's not, I don't want to make too much of it. And he certainly fits in well with the ensemble of really brilliant people. I mean, what a cast, what a embarrassment of riches. This, what fascinates me so much about the play, as Peter alluded to, in some ways, I guess stylistically, it's so dated, and yet the message is even more timely than ever. I mean, I think if anything, we have more of an emphasis nowadays on making tremendous amounts of money in whatever job you do, even if you hate your job. So that, we certainly don't have less of that than they had in the 30s. That's completely still very timely. And then also, I guess we have new terms for it now, finding your bliss. Didn't one of the reviews mention that? And the other thing is, does everyone know this? This play served as the template for so many things since then, so many other plays, TV sitcoms, films, that it's only natural that in some ways it might seem somewhat dated. And it's been cited as the primary inspiration for the Munsters. Did you both know that?
No, I never did.
When you think about it, it's perfect.
Yeah, there's this all set. Yep.
absolutely crazy family with the daughter in both cases. The daughter being the only quote unquote normal one. And then people in various ways, people from the outside world start interacting with these loony people. And that's where the comedy comes from.
Isn't that something that is a wonderful analogy? It really is. That never occurred to me.
Yes. And I mean, to a lesser extent, the Addams Family, because they don't have a normal daughter or son, and they don't, well, but they also they certainly interacted with the outside world too. So that a little less so, but absolutely definitely the Munsters. And in fact, didn't Fred Gwynne play Grandpa? And
yes, sure. So, he did the Munsters. Get him. He knows what he's doing. Yeah. So
I thought, the friend who I brought, we both really absolutely loved it. It's just great to see it. I hope it keeps being revived. I have not seen it since the last Broadway revival, which was some years ago. And I didn't look up the date. I'm sorry, but it was quite a while ago.
84, I think. If we're talking about the one, the paper mill and the transferred with Jason Robards.
Yes. And wasn't that, I didn't look it up. Wasn't it televised?
Yes, it certainly was. There's a DVD of it, too, should people want to track that down. It's a very nice production indeed. I'm wrong. It's 83. It closed on January 1st, 84, so it didn't run much of 84. But, James Coco, Colleen Dewhurst, Jason Robards, Elizabeth Wilson, Maureen Andaman, good people. You know what else is wonderful about this play? We have to remember that this is a play from way back when. However, even though it was first produced in 1936. It's so wonderful how this family deals with the two black people who are in the cast. One is their certainly their servant and her boyfriend. However, she sits down to eat dinner with them. She is treated in many ways like an equal. Yes, they do ask her to go get things, that type of thing. But But nevertheless, it's so wonderful to see her sitting down at that table with them and her boyfriend sitting down at that table with them. And everybody is just talking and having a wonderful time. And that's really quite forward thinking for a play from 1936.
Although I will say that I don't know if you noticed this, Peter, the one uncomfortable moment in the entire evening that I noticed is on two or three occasions this character Donald, the one you just mentioned, the boyfriend of their servant, their maid, he mentions that he's on relief.
Yes, and, that is true. Yeah.
Yes, and when he said, because it was, I guess, the one black male character in the
sure.
play, as opposed to, even though James Earl right. Jones is playing.
Anybody else yeah. could have, yeah. right.
But yeah, when he said that, the audience, I did hear kind of like, almost like, oh, you know, yeah, like little grumblings. Yeah. But, and coincidentally, as I recall, the first time that Donald says this is before Grandpa tells us that he's not paying taxes. So it's not supposed to, in context, it's not supposed to be anything awful about this guy being on relief, especially if this, the patriarch of this, right. you know, very old traditional white family is not paying taxes. Mm-hmm. But I did notice that. So that was just something that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's fair.
So I can't disagree with either one of you that we had a wonderful time there. It is an embarrassment of the riches, the cast. And one of the things that I was, put a business hat on because the art up there was so wonderful. I was wondering if from a different perspective, this cast is huge.
Mm.
You know, for a play to yes. have, 27 people on the cast.
It's,
and I mean, like Nick Corley, who is in for like 4.5 minutes, who yes. is wonderful. Nick Corley is amazing, but I'm like, you know, I literally, he was one of the government men. He had very few minutes on stage, but that, I wonder how, you know, they can make this last. Is this a limited run or do we know?
Yeah, the famous January 4th.
Something else, right after we talked last week, once.
Yeah, right, said January 4th.
Once
yeah,
pulled yeah. out the January 4th, the Felicia
card,
date.
Yes. Oh, is that when I'm dropping dead?
Oh, I don't please, think, God, take that back.
I don't think Peter wants to be associated with that date.
excuse me. January 4th, with such a large cast, I hope that they've saved money in other ways to make this pay off for whoever is financing this venture. But this is we had a wonderful time. It was such a breath of fresh air. As I mentioned, Jason Robert Brown did some incidental music for it. And if you put a gun to my head and asked me to hum something, I'd be dead because I can't remember any of it. Can you?
No, not in that way, but it was sweet stuff.
Yeah, and certainly period.
Mm-hmm.
And
The set was really quite something.
Yeah.
I did not feel that it necessarily added anything for the revolve that they have. But other than that, I mean, you could have spent the whole night just staring at the way the walls were, the knickknacks on the walls.
Sure.
It was incredible.
Yeah. Every square inch taken with a photo yes, indeed.
I have to imagine that there's got to be some inside jokes happening up there that I hope that somebody lets us in on you know, various little things that would be built into the set that mean something other than the obvious to the audience. I also, in a strange meta way, Tony Shalhoub sat in front of us. So Mozart play with Tony Shalhoub in front of us. He played Mozart last season, and so it was. We had a wonderful time. So
did you ask him how he felt they did with his script?
I wasn't quick enough. I was just like, "Oh, it's Tony Shalhoub!" I was so excited. So all right. Well, let's move on to the next show, which is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime over at the Barrymore. And Michael, why don't you give us a start on that?
The friend that I brought described her word, her one word review was marvelous. And I think that's really great. It's a wonderful play, apparently based on a book that I haven't read. And it's by Simon Stevens, based on the novel by Mark Haddon. And it comes to us from London. And it's about a young man, about 15, I believe, who is – they never actually use this word, do they? But he's autistic. He's somewhere kind of far on the autism spectrum. And he the precipitating fact of the play is that a neighbor's dog is killed. And he the boy Christopher, played by Alex Sharp, with Taylor Trench alternating for matinees, he makes it his business to investigate the murder of this dog. And we often hear of people with autism, he has a very analytical mind, and so he uses his skills in that area to kind of map out possibilities and then just follow them through and investigate. But that is only the precipitating fact, and then there are all sorts of really other interesting things that happen. Christopher is living alone with his father, apparently his mother having died about 2 or 3 years earlier, during a long stay in the hospital. So he has no mother, and it's the two of them, and they don't always get along very well. But then turns out that not all of that is what it seems, and he embarks on a journey. And I don't want to say too much more. The physical production is especially marvelous. It's really quite something. Scenic and costume design by Bunny Christie, lighting by Paul Constable, video design, which must be mentioned, by Finn Ross, and the whole thing just comes together just really, really brilliantly, directed by Marianne Elliott. It's whatever hype you may have heard. I don't know if hype is the right word. But if that is the right word, it really lives up to it. It's quite a wonderful evening. And Alex Sharp, he's the one I saw. Aside from everything else, I don't know how he does it even six times a week, because there's a lot of shouting in his role. He is just out of Juilliard. He's been getting rave reviews. A Tony nomination is absolutely assured. I have no question about it, and I would not be, you know, I sometimes annoys me when people do this early in the season, but I would not be a bit surprised if he wins a Tony for this. It's extraordinary, and I hope you all get to see it.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
I thought it started a little slowly, I love plays that start slowly and keep accelerating, and that's what happens. Once the foot is on the pedal is to the metal, and it works very effectively. I wasn't even that impressed with the boy for the first 2 or 3 minutes, but that certainly changed, and it is riveting. Also, in a strange way, it reminded me of The Sixth Sense. That movie in which at one point we learn exactly what's going on. I'm not going to spoil the picture for those who don't know it, just in case somebody is getting to watch it tonight. But there's a moment when I realized, oh, wait a minute, what we've been told is not true. And it was exactly the precise moment before we were told what was true. Now, this may mean, of course, that I'm a little slow to catch on to what's going on, and it's very possible everybody else in the theater was knew long before that something we had been told turned out not to be true. But anyway, it was. I like when that happens, when I'm just right at the point where they want me to be, at the point where they want me to be. So I like that very, very much. It certainly is a workout for this kid. I don't resent at all that there are two times a week when he's not going to do it. The father, I think, is particularly good. I think he's really quite wonderful in this role, and it's a tough part for a daddy. There's no question that this play does reiterate the fact that bringing up a child like this is just so, so hard. You try to do your best. You try not to get angry. At times you do fly off the handle because you've just had so much. And when you do, you feel terrible and you wind up apologizing to the kid who doesn't even need the apology. You don't know what he needs. You don't know how much he's accepting of the apology. You don't know if he, it seems like things bother him, but for a very short period of time. One of the things that bothers him is he doesn't want to be touched. And the point is that is so well done in this play, so well established and so well directed. When somebody touches him, you wind up feeling violated, that you jump in your seat, that that is in that way. And when a play can do that, that's really quite effective. And so I am now interested in reading the novel. There is a novel on which this play was based. So as much credit as we want to give Simon Stevens, and I'll give him plenty, I want to see what Mark Haddon's novel is like. And tracking it down to see that is going to be, I think, quite an illuminating experience. And we shall certainly see what that's like. But everybody in it is so quite wonderful, and it's very theatrical in the sense that there are people who are not in the scene who talk to us and fill us in on things. While, yes, the set design is terrific, please don't go expecting to have your eyes knocked out by conventional scenery. Mm-hmm. This is not a play that relies on conventional scenery at all. It's simply, in essence, dark graph paper on each of the three walls of the stage. But there will be some interesting things that happen to it, I guarantee you. And so yes, this is must-see theater. It really is. And I hope that it does well. It certainly was a big hit in London. I can't tell you how many people came back from London saying, I couldn't get in. And this is before the theater ceiling fell down. This was the theater where that was playing, I believe. And so it's a big hit there. I hope it becomes quite a hot hit here. A lot of people were saying at intermission, well, this is the season snob hit, a term I think initiated by William Goldman in that
season.
No, he didn't do that?
Oh, no. No, I mean, I completely disagree.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
anyway, that this will be the play that people see because they think they have to see. I'm not even sure that there's even that much mileage in snob hits anymore. That I don't know if people think they have to go to the theater to see what is deemed to be important. That pressure, I think, was much more prevalent in the 60s. Given the fact that we're now in a musical-centric Broadway, which we weren't as much in the 60s, even though it was going in that direction, I don't know if people feel that they have to see this year's quote-unquote most important play. We'll have to wait and see how the grosses are. But I do hope people go because, yes, this Alex Sharp is truly, truly, truly remarkable. But I would like to see the other boy, too. I think that would be something to see. And what I hope is that he's not doing a carbon copy performance of this young man. The character's name is Christopher Boone. But watching the parents deal with him, I mean, you know, also – let me point out that the baby boomer generation seemed to be the one that regrettably, and believe me, I'm a member of this generation, but regrettably came up with a term, I can't do this anymore. You know, when things get tough, that seems to be the excuse that people give, you know, and it's supposed to be one that's acceptable. That comes up in this play, too, in essence. I'm not saying that exact sentence is used, but there is somebody in the play who can't do this anymore. And that brings with it a lot of ramifications as well. So I know I'm being cryptic, purposely so. I don't want to give too much away. But the reason is because I want you all out there to go and see it, because I think you'll be pleased that you do.
We had a really wonderful time. I can't dispute anything that either one of you said again.
Peter, I wanted to clarify. I'm not questioning your perception that people are saying it's a stop hit. I'm just saying that how completely I disagree with that, because to me that implies something that's not any good and people are just going to it because they've been told that it's good. So that's what I meant. I have not read the book, but the person whom I brought did read it, and she said not only did she love it, but she said she could not have imagined any stage adaptation, let alone one so marvelous, again, to use her word. So I think that's you know, that's certainly a testament to what has been done here. We should mention Francesca Faradani. I hope I'm saying it right. Who plays Siobhan, Christopher's teacher, because she carries a lot of the weight of actually reading, sort of reading as if from the book or his or Christopher's words, or and sometimes other people's things that other people are saying. I think they did that. I'm guessing maybe they did that largely to take some of the burden off of whoever's playing Christopher, because it really is just it's a tour de force, stellar marathon role. It's quite incredible.
So we were going through the list of awards that this show could win, because I certainly think it's going to take a lot of them. And of course, Alex Sharp is going to lead the pack there. And in fact, it's his Broadway debut. I think there could be a Theater World Award in his future, couldn't there be?
I think so, yeah.
So we were listing the different things that it could win, and I, of course, set design was really clever and amazing, and then I thought to myself, oh, sound design, and then it occurred to me that, oh, sound design Tony has been eliminated.
Yeah.
So here's a great example of how sound is so important to a show, and this added just amazing depth to what was happening to the story. So maybe they'll award it a special Tony for sound.
That's a very good way to get out of it, sure.
But I feel like this is a hard marketing challenge, because the title of the play doesn't do it justice insofar as selling it.
Right.
It makes total sense in the context of the play itself, but it's not a great marketing tool. And I think that it's going to be up to I'm not going to put it all on the three of us, but people like the three of us to go out there and tell others how wonderful this is and that this is a must see.
Oh, and by the way, if you go, if you haven't already read this, don't leave immediately the curtain call.
Yeah. Every show I go to, we have these people that just can't bear to spend the extra minute in their life, and they ran out of the theater and they missed that. And so I won't tell you what that is, but stay if you do go to see it, because it's wonderful. And so I guess that's it. The curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. Get your tickets if you can. I don't know. How's it doing in the box? Do we know anything?
I haven't noticed.
I haven't noticed either, yeah. All right, so next up, Michael and Peter got a chance to see Tailspin. And for those acute listeners out there, last week we in the show notes and in the tease of the show, I talked about Tailspin and that Michael saw it, and it wasn't in the show. It's because it was a terrible editing mistake. So we'll have Michael and Peter tell us about it again this week. So Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Yeah, I'm glad to have an opportunity to talk about it again. This is a Culture Project production down at 45 Bleecker in the Lynn Redgrave Theater. And again, I'm so happy that there is a Lynn Redgrave Theater now. That's a wonderful thing. And they have some really great stuff down there. It's, you know, it's a little far removed from the traditional Broadway theater district, but definitely worth the trip and not hard to get to by subway. So put that on your map if it's not there. And this play by Mario Correa is all about the sex scandals that happened in recent years of four different elected officials. We had Representative Mark Foley, Senator Larry Craig, Governor Mark Sanford, and for us New Yorkers, Representative Anthony Weiner. And they are played by, Mark Foley's played by Arnie Burton, Larry Craig by Sean Dugan, Mark Sanford by Tom Galantic, and Anthony Weiner by someone I had not previously seen on stage, who was not only looked almost exactly like Anthony Weiner, except I would say a little more handsome, but he did a terrific job, and his name is Nate Smith. And they also play, all of those people also play small other roles. The way it happens is that each scandal is presented complete, you know, and I mean, they go through one and then there's a little break and then they go through the other three successively. And so these all these other men in it also play small roles. But the ace in the deck is Rachel Dratch, who plays, and I love the billing, Wives, Tales, Beards, and Barbara Walters. And her Barbara Walters, it comes only at the very end of the show, but it is incredibly worth waiting for. She's fantastic. All of the four men are great. And the hook here is that every word in the play is taken from actual words that were spoken by these four men and their wives and their interviewers, and there's nothing that's made up except I guess maybe the introduction where they tell you this. the introduction to the play, very well directed by Dan Knechtkis, if I'm saying that right. And the play had actually more sleeker production values than I would have thought. One thing they do that's very helpful is there's a large, wide sort of movie screen type thing at the back top of the stage, on which text is flashed. But one of the things that they include is that if someone, for example, if the fellow playing Larry Craig is standing stage right over his head, it will say Larry Craig. And then if an interviewer is standing stage left at the same time, it will say Barbara Walters or whoever it happens to be. And that does help because they are, you know, especially at the beginning of each segment, it helps you just be sure who's, you know, who they're talking about and what's going on. I loved it. The audience was in hysterics. It's kind of, I guess, sang-froid to kind of watch these people going through these scandals, and there can be moments when it's not funny, and you kind of feel I guess you could sympathize with them for the vice closing in, but for the most part it's done in a very kind of comic, over the top way. So it's not, I wouldn't say they're I wouldn't say the people are humanized. I don't think that's that would be a word to use, it because that's not the approach of the play. And again, it's just their own words. I really loved it, and I wish it a long run, and I think everyone should try to see it.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Well, it does show us what words can do, as Michael says, verbatim. So you have the Larry Craig statement of, my father taught me not to quit the job. You know, so here he is in the scandal, and he's not going to quit because his father gave him this wisdom. And, you know, this is a very clever way of approaching the situation, not quitting. Richard Nixon said this in the penultimate speech he gave. I'm not quitting to do the job I was elected to do because, you know, of course, that makes you seem noble, that you're willing to stay on despite all this controversy when everybody wants you out, but you give this reason. Weiner also said, I'm responding so my colleagues can get back to work. Yes, again, the nobility of it all, you know, that I don't want to be a pest. I want to make sure that work gets done, the necessary work of politics gets done. So, Weiner's wife saying, our marriage, like so many others, has had its ups and downs, you know, like so many others. That's very clever, you know, essentially saying, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. So Sanford, who you may recall had the liaison in Argentina while he claimed he was on the Appalachian Trail, his statement was, the last few days, the Appalachian Trail is not where I ended up. Like he had no power over where he was going. He was a magnet who was just pulled in a direction without having anything to say about it. You have to admire Mrs. Sanford for not standing by her man. But the play also suggests Lord knows what's going on in everybody's life. I'm including me in that. You know, I mean, you know, who? How many people are getting away with exactly what these people were caught doing? What's really nice is they play fair in the sense that there are two straight couples. Well, there's ostensibly all straight couples, but my point is there are two gay scandals and two straight scandals. And I like that very much. I thought that was really good to do it in that way. So, but, you know, as happens as we get older and we see what goes on in politics, you have to come down to that famous statement made by both Oscar Wilde and Inspector Clouseau. I believe everything and I believe nothing. I mean, who can really have that much faith in our leaders? It's a terrible thing to say, but really any one of them could be brought down tomorrow by this terrible scandal that we don't see on the horizon at all. Who saw this coming with any of these poor guys? And yet it happened and it's going to happen again. I don't think anybody would say, well, that's it for the scandals. We're not going to see any more political scandals. Oh, yes, we are. And we're going to see scandals in every other field, too, because virtually all of us have a dark side, and this play certainly brings out the fact that four people who were very high up at one time certainly were brought down for having their dark sides.
But let me say, I think it's so incredibly weird and ironic that it's the sex scandals that normally get all the attention and wind up driving these people out of their offices, when theoretically, in most cases, it's not anyone's business. If sure. they're doing, you know, I mean, it's all, well, it's the business of them. And if they have a wife or a partner, and, you know, then sometimes there are situations where people doing things, I guess, on work hours. So I guess that's an issue, too. But it's just that whole kind of puritanical streak in this country.
Yes. Yes.
It is. I mean, to me, there are things that politicians do that are completely unrelated to sex that are 1,000 times worse than any of this stuff. And I'm accepting the guy who's supposed to be involved with the underage page.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, I mean, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about consensual adult sex. Isn't that interesting? Don't you think?
I am going to take the liberty of jumping. I spoke to James and Michael about this beforehand, but the word Puritan, since it's come up, I'm going to bring up a musical I saw this week that many of you will not have seen. It was an industry reading, and usually you're not supposed to spill the beans on what's going on in these industry readings. But when they're this good, attention must be paid. Now, I will admit the title doesn't suggest it's going to be very good at all, because it's called Something Rotten. And Puritans do factor into it. Bear with me. So, Something Rotten is a new musical. Kevin McCollum, one of our finest producers, is interested in taking it to the next level. At this level, it's phenomenal. People unknown to me wrote it. Music and lyrics by Wayne Kirkpatrick and Carrie Kirkpatrick, Carrie with a K. The book is by Carrie Kirkpatrick and John O'Farrell. Now, we're in Shakespeare's time. And Brian D'Arcy James, who would win a Tony for this performance, is playing Nick Bottom. All right. Many of you know that Nick Bottom is a character in A Midsummer Night's Dream. But this never comes up, no more than the fact that there's a character named Shylock, played by Jerry Vickie. No more than there's a character named Bea, who I assume is Beatrice, in Much Ado. Beth Level plays her. I'm telling you, what a cast. It's just amazing. So, what it is, Nick Bottom is a play, is a director, and his brother Nigel, played by John Cariani, another Tony nominee, is the writer. And they are having a tough time of it because Shakespeare is so popular. And they can't get anywhere because everybody just talks about Shakespeare night and day. And this really infuriates Brian D'Arcy James, who tries to put down Shakespeare as not being that good, you know, while Nigel Bottom admits that Shakespeare is really quite something. And he's not nearly as good. So Christian Bale plays Shakespeare. I'm telling you, what a cast. And wow. And it's done. I'm telling you, the thing is that everything I hate about new musicals is here. everything I hate. And yet it's done on such a high level, I had to waive the rules because anachronisms. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But not in the way Aladdin does it. What it does, Shakespeare is really presented as a rock star. And he is actually, when he's seeing people, he is really in a rock star mode, even to the point of which he's doing all those rock star gestures where he's saying, okay, after me, you know, shall I? And they go, shall I? Compare thee to a summer's day. You know, that's a, and you don't resent it because it's on such a high level. For example, what happens is that Nick Bottom decides he's got to do something different, and he goes to a soothsayer who is Nostradamus. Not the Nostradamus, by the way, a cousin, Thomas Nostradamus, but this played by Brad Oscar. Phenomenal performance, Brad Oscar, who says, oh, I see the future, and the future is going to be in musicals. And out comes this enormous production number about musicals. Yes, again, the type of thing I usually hate. But there's so much clever because Brad Oscar's there saying, and there's going to be something called an 11 o'clock number. And Shakespeare, Nick Bottom says, what, just before noon? Because, of course, in those days, they did not have evening performances. All the shows were matinees because they didn't have lights. So 11 o'clock to him means that. Similarly speaking, I don't know if this is going to go over with the crowds in Jersey. Well, yes, there's a Jersey over there, too. You know, so, you know, I mean, they really make it so good. You know, that's what's so wonderful. See, you're laughing, you know. So I think that is so terrific that they really have the jokes being intelligent. So Beth Level wants to help her husband. They're not doing well at all. So she pretends to be a man. You know, this certainly happened in Shakespeare's era. And she decides to go out and get a job. And what's so wonderful is that the moment he sees her disguised as a man, he says, B, what are you doing? You know, none of this, he's confused, you know, I mean, that type of, he doesn't recognize her right away. And I like that so much. So she said, I got a job. I'm a bear shit boy. And I go around, I collect bear shit, you know, he says, oh, no, that's terrible. No, I got a promotion. Today they gave me a bucket. So I'm telling
you. It sounds great.
It is phenomenal. The music is terrific. The lyrics are smart. And again, you know, I mean, so many wonderful people in it. Kate Rangers is in it because she plays the daughter of, here I come, a Puritan. And he wants to close down the show.
Oh.
And she falls in love with Nigel, the playwright. And, you know, that's going to be really hard. Now, all the time I'm watching this, I'm saying, but they're painting themselves into a corner because we know that Shakespeare is going to endure. We know that Nick Bottom is not. We know that he's not going to come out with a bigger hit than Shakespeare came out with. What are they going to do? And that I'm going to leave. I will admit it's not 100% wonderful, the conclusion, but it's pretty good. And it's imaginative, too. And they do come out of that corner, maybe with a footprint of paint on, but no more than that. So Ellen Fitzpatrick plays her her father, who is just furious that this sinful theater is going on. And Kate, of course, playing a character named Portia, is one who is torn between the love for her father and the love for her new guy, who she just thinks is terrific. Now, the thing is, nothing is ever, 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 ever made of the fact that these names wind up in Shakespeare's plays eventually. But there is the implication that Shakespeare has borrowed from so many people that you do feel that after this musical is over, that the Shakespeare in this musical would go out and use these people's names because he felt free to borrow from wherever he felt like borrowing. So that's kind of interesting, too. So I don't know if this is on Slate for the they're raring to go. Casey Nicholaw directed and choreographed. I'm telling you, great, great, great staff. And if a theater opens up, it was a production. It wasn't a reading. It was a production. People were singing and dancing. I'm telling you, it was great. And I do believe that if we don't see it this season, we're going to see it next season. But I'm ready to give it the Tony vote for the best musical of this or next season already because it was such fun. And again, for trumping the things that I usually hate, you know, musicals referencing musicals and anachronisms. They're just of so high an order that I just couldn't help be super impressed. So I wish it well, and I hope it comes back very, very soon so that all of you can see it out there. I think you'll have a hell of a time.
Well, in some ways, it sounds a little similar to maybe the tone of Shakespeare in Love. So maybe Harvey Weinstein will produce the musical.
Of course, it's impossible not to think of Shakespeare in Love, because the wonderful thing about Shakespeare in Love was one of the messages was, you know, for all the years that have passed, the business is still the same. They have the same problems, even to the point of which when Shakespeare is taking a boat to meet Viola, and the boat guy driving the boat is saying, you know, I've written a play, you know what I mean? And, you know, and I got it here, you know. So, of course, you know, like cab drivers do and all of us do, you know, so who have a play that we've written. So, yes, there. It's impossible not to think of Shakespeare in Love, but this is this really is a genuine musical, and I'm telling you, you know, the production number of that it's a musical that I don't know that that's really the title, because there were no songs listed in the program, but I'm already ready to say best musical. I'm already to say best actor in a musical for Brian Darcy James, and the first three-way tie for best featured actor in a musical to John Cariani, who, as I say, played the playwright. Brad Oscar, just phenomenal beyond belief, and Christian Bale, who really has the swagger of somebody who owns the world. He's great, and he knows it, and he doesn't care that you know that he has an ego the size of Rhode Island, which may not be a big state, but it's big for an ego. So as a result, you know, three-way tie. Casey Nicola, best director, choreographer, please let this happen. Do not let this project die, Kevin McCullum or whoever else wants to take it on. But this is an amazing musical.
Well, it's all the buzz of the insiders in the last couple of days. So I suppose that we will see it move forward in some fashion or so. Hopefully you will see it in the 15-16 season. So, Michael, you got a chance to see The Guys on Staten Island. So what'd you think about it?
I loved it. This was a tie-in. It was a production of the Staten Island Shakespearean Theater, which obviously doesn't just do Shakespeare. They do lots of wonderful plays. And this play, for those who are not aware of it, you should be. I hesitate to use the word miraculous, but I kind of almost think that's what it is. It was first presented on December 4th, 2001, so less than 4 months after 9/11. And it was, I don't know if it was an official commission, but what happened was that Jim Simpson of the Flea Theater, I believe, went to this woman named Ann Nelson, who had never written a play before at that time. She's an author and a lecturer, but had never actually written a play. And she wrote this amazing play based, I'm not sure if it's two actual characters, but about a fire department captain who has lost 8 men from his company alone in the World Trade Center. And he, as their captain, is required and expected to give their eulogies. But he is not that type of a person who's good with words. He's just not used to that type of public speaking, or writing. So he goes to his name is Nick, by the way, and he goes to a woman named Joan, who is a writer and an editor, and he goes to her apartment in Brooklyn to help him compose the eulogies for these 8 men. And that is, it's just one scene after another of them sitting there and him talking about each of these guys, the guys, and then Joan makes notes, and then she works it into these beautiful, simple, very meaningful, moving eulogies, and she hands them to him, and he reads them. And then those scenes are broken up with Joan sort of talking to the audience, if you will, and just giving her thoughts on 9/11 and how devastating it was, and But the thing is that obviously there was a tremendous responsibility that Ann Nelson took on in writing this play. And I think that even if it had been less good than it was, it probably would have achieved a certain amount of success and critical acclaim just because of the subject matter. But she did such a good job with it that I can't, you know, I really can't imagine anyone writing anything better on the subject that close to that horrific event, especially. And I would say a very difficult setup that she set for herself, because it's really just these two people talking, and as I said, him telling her about these guys, and then her just jotting down things and saying, oh, well, why don't you try this? How does this sound? Not maybe inherently dramatic in terms of how it's done, but it's just beautifully written and so moving, and it doesn't never steps over the line, never feels remotely exploitive. So I've always loved the play, and it's been given a really terrific production by Staten Island Shakespearean Theater, which unfortunately will be over by the time you hear this. Plays, shows on Staten Island don't tend to run very long by design. They're usually 2 or 3 weekends at the most. But Nick was played by Joseph Daly, who's an old friend of mine, so let me say that from the beginning. But he really was superb. He has, I guess, basically his basic normal accent has a bit of a New York tinge to it. He ramped that up for Nick, and that worked perfectly because it's that kind of a guy, just a very kind of old New York traditional guy who won pictures as a firefighter. And so I knew Joe's work, and I mean, he was even better than I ever thought he would be, just really superb. But I had never heard of the woman before. She's considerably younger. Her name is Andrea Kelly, and she was perfect as Joan. I'm really glad I got to see it again. I saw the show almost very shortly after it had opened. It opened with Sigourney Weaver and Bill Murray. But then, if my memory serves, Bill Murray was only in it very briefly. And I think his first replacement was Anthony LaPaglia. And I saw the two of them, Sigourney Weaver and Anthony LaPaglia. And then there is a film version of it with those two, which I urge you to check out. It didn't do very well at all for reasons that I think you might imagine. But it's quite good. Still, it's inherently a theatrical piece, as you probably would imagine from my description of it. And it's not done that often. Again, I'm sure you can figure out why. But and not easy to sit through, I would say. But also not, as I said, not exploitive, and not it's so well done that it really deserves to be seen. And if not, try to get a copy of it. I think reading it would also be a very, very worthwhile experience. Ann Nelson's The Guys.
All right. Peter, you got a chance to see Big, the musical at the York, which is having it for just 10 performances. There's only a few left. I fear.
Yeah, this is more than Mufti usually offers. It used to be one weekend, but musicals right. And Mufti's are now going to 2 weekends, which is wonderful, which indicates that people are appreciating what's going on in this series that Jim Morgan runs, where indeed musicals of the past are resuscitated. And here's Big, which in 1996 didn't do well at all. In my book, The Biggest Hit of the Season, The Biggest Flop of the Season, I mentioned this one for the 1995-96 season because it lost $10 million. Now, of course, if Spider-Man wound up losing $10 million, they would have proclaimed themselves a hit. But but as Daddy Warbucks says, that was a lot of money in those days. And but it's a musical that I really followed very closely because at the Star Ledger, I was asked to do a 4-part series on Big, and I went out to Detroit to see the tryout. And I was with it every step of the way, seeing what changes were made. I'm one of the few people to see the epilogue that was in early in Detroit, where after the famous big movie ends, we find out what happens 6 months later to everybody. That wasn't in for very long, believe me. But anyway, it's a show I've always had great affection for, not just because I worked so closely with it and got to know everybody involved with it, but I truly believe, as I wrote in the book, that if this had been produced a year before, when it was supposed to be, but the producers were gun-shy about going up against the then unsinkable, how are you going to compete against it, Sunset Boulevard, they said, let's wait a year, because we're not going to win the Tony, because Sunset Boulevard will win the Tony. And that's too bad, because if it had gone up against Sunset Boulevard, I bet it would have beaten it, because everybody said, oh, what a fresh American musical at last, you know, that type of thing. But suddenly, this was happening around the time that Rent was happening, and Rent was the wave of the future, and Big came across to many people as a dinosaur, but that doesn't mean it's not a good musical. And one thing that it does very, very, very well that the movie never addresses, never, is the fact that if you were a kid who suddenly wound up being in a situation where you had this terrific job, this terrific apartment, this terrific girlfriend, why would you want to go back? Are you crazy? Go back and have to start doing homework and answering to parents and all this kind of business? Why would you? And John Wideman very cleverly brought up the fact that even though he has been so lucky to stumble into this job and he's fooling everybody all of the time at this job, what about the rest of his life? What happens when he has to deal socially with people? And when he has his girlfriend, Susan, and she says, I want you to meet my friends, that's when he performs disastrously. He cannot keep up with the friends. He stumbles. He makes mistakes. They start looking at him strangely. And that's when he realizes he's out of his league. Professionally, he's been able to make it. On a personal level, he cannot, and that's why he wants to go back, because he knows he can't compete in the adult world in that fashion. So, very smart idea. It does answer that question. However, you know, the one thing that Big, both in the movie and in the musical, never is able to conquer is the fact that, you know, if your kid is missing and your parents, you know, that's a terrible thing to live through. And Josh comes off as somewhat insensitive for allowing his parents to go through hell while he's missing. There's just no fun in that at all. Big has often been criticized for having a wonderful song that isn't right for the moment. And that is a song called Stop Time, in which a mother thinks about the fact, and I relate to this as a parent, James, I'm sure you do, and Michael, I'm sure you have nieces and nephews that you can understand where, you know, that each child is replaced by another child as kids get older, that the 3-year-old version is very different from the 7-year-old version, which is different from the 10-year-old version. And as Josh is about to turn 13, as the lyric goes, now the real changes start. And it's true. You know, it's a beautiful song, but one does wonder if a mother hasn't seen her child in a number of weeks, is this the song she's singing on his birthday? I don't think so. So, you know, what's really so sad is that the solution, I think, should be that at the beginning of the show, the parents should be ready to go on a safari to Africa, and Josh is going to be whisked off to overnight camp. Well, they're on the sidewalk waiting for their rides to arrive. As it turns out, the parents' rides arrives first. They kiss Josh goodbye. The bus will be here in a minute. You know, we're going to go. They go to Africa. Okay, fine. So Josh goes back into the house to use the bathroom, and that's when the change occurs. There's no reason why it has to happen overnight. The change could come at any time. Suddenly he's a big guy. He doesn't know what to do. The bus shows up. He doesn't get on the bus. They wonder where he is. They call the house. The answering machine says, hi, we're on safari. Oh, I guess we got it wrong. And that way the camp doesn't worry either. You know, they go away. The parents are in Africa. So it all takes place with nobody having to worry for a tenth of a second. Under those circumstances, we can enjoy the show more, too. And wouldn't it be wonderful at the end, after Josh decides to come back and be young again, that his parents come home and say, well, did you have a nice adventure out there? Yes, I had a wonderful adventure. But are you glad to be home? Yeah, I'm very glad to be home. You know, and that would be so wonderful. It would solve that problem. Anyway, let's talk about the production that's it's a staged reading, but wonderfully done by Michael Unger, with wonderful music direction by Eric Svegar, who, I'm telling you, throws his heart and soul into this music. They couldn't have done better in the entire history of the world than getting John Turturro to play older Josh. I mean, because he has that wonderful childlike quality about him. So he's able to tie into the fact when Josh has to react like a 13-year-old boy as opposed to a 30-something man. Carrie Butler is wonderful as Susan. But also... In the cast, I have to give a shout out to Hayden Wall. Hayden appeared as my Tiny Tim character in my new version of A Christmas Carol last year. It's called Adam's Gift, and he did a phenomenal job. He's a real pro. I'm telling you, he works so hard. He never complains. You ask him to do something over 12 to 15 times, he does it. And he's wonderful as young Josh. We don't see much of him as time goes on, of course, because he disappears in favor of John Turturro. But he's really, really, really good. Janet Metz, who many of you may know, she was Mabel in Paper Mills, Mac and Mabel some time ago, plays the mother and does very well by Stop Time, no question about that. But again, I think it's the song in the wrong place. Walter Charles playing the boss of the toy company? No, not at the performance I saw. He had to miss performances. I don't know if he's coming back. I don't know. However, in his place was Richard Maltby. Yeah, Richard Maltby got up there and did the part and did it very, very well, as you would expect. I mean, yeah, he certainly knows the lyrics. And you know, it was amazing to see an audience take to this show so much. I saw it quite a bit on Broadway. And I have to admit that Big suffers from the fact that you think it's going to be a kid's show, but it deals with so many adult themes. And I have to admit that the fifth time I saw it on Broadway, in the middle of the second act, I was sitting next to a little girl, and next to her was her mother. And in the middle of the second act, the mother said, "Are you watching this?" You know, and the kid had tuned out. It's a tough show for kids. It really isn't a kid's show, even though there's something about it that makes you think it is. It's an adult show. And last night, the place was full of adults who adored it. And I was thinking, where were these people in 1996? You know, they could have used them then. But jokes that I saw fall flat in 1996 were tearing the house down. And so if you can get to Big this weekend, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. It's a show that needs to be seen again, despite its lapses in logic and what have you. What's there is very choice. And if you did see Big in 1996, this is not the same Big, because they went back to work on it and they took out some songs. They've added eight others. And of course, you know, being Maltby and Shire, you know, it's going to be of a high quality, and every one of those songs is. So I love when people work on shows after the fact, you know, that they say, all right, you know, maybe we can make it better. Now that we have time at our disposal, we don't have to have anything in by Tuesday night, you know, that type of thing. Let's work on it. And they did, and they have. So they have certainly done a good job of strengthening it in a property that I think was pretty strong to begin with. So by all means, get to Mufti and see Big.
Well, Peter and I both saw the tour, the touring production of the of our revised version. I don't know how similar would you say this revised
version? Pretty. Okay. It's closer to this. It's closer to the tour version than it is to the Broadway production. I didn't know you saw that. Did we? I saw it in Wilmington. Were you there the same day I was? Is that?
Oh no,
you...
I saw it at the Orange County Performing Arts Center.
I see.
Yeah, with Jim Newman as Josh.
Yes, Jim Newman. Yes, that's the tour that I saw too. But I saw it in Wilmington. It's amazing to me that I've seen the show in five states. You know, because it's supposed to be this big failure. But I've seen productions in Maryland, and I've also seen a production in Illinois. So so that's really quite wonderful. I'm very, very glad that people do it, because it does deserve a lot of attention.
That's great. You know, and I absolutely agree with you, Peter, that I loved the movie. I adored the movie. But from the moment that I remember sitting in the theater watching the movie, and I'm like, what, how they really did not deal well with the fact that he disappears. I think I can't remember now. They try to deal with it somehow that he calls, or does he have his
but right. He calls and says, look, everything's okay. You know, yeah, right. I mean, now I can rest. My kid isn't here, but he called and said everything's okay.
Well, not only that, but he, I mean, it's obviously his adult voice, and the mother, if I recall, is like, who is this? And what are you doing? Right. What have you done with my child? Yeah. So that wasn't a good, there are many solutions, including the one you suggested, Peter, that one could envision as to why they think he's somewhere else. You know, and they think he is okay. So it's not an issue. And then she could sing Stop Time and we wouldn't have to worry about, well, why don't you have the detectives out? You know, why aren't you running all over the tri-state area or wherever they are to find this kid?
In fact, early in the show, when they're at the when they're at the carnival, she kisses him and he's so embarrassed to be seen being kissed by his mother. And he wipes off the kiss. We've all done that. We know what that's like, to be embarrassed by our mothers. And the thing is, that's the place for Stop Time. You know, the last section deals with if he could only come back, if we could only drop those lyrics. Again, Maltby writes a lot of lyrics here in the new one. Put that song there, because that's where it is about how kids change as they grow up. There was a time when he loved being kissed by me and now he doesn't anymore. So that's the logical place for Stop Time, where it doesn't have to bear the weight of the fact that we're saying, why isn't this woman, as you say, Michael, sending off for the police? I mean, we do see the police at one point, very, very fleetingly. But it does seem like out of sight, out of mind, almost, that the mother, it really isn't a good solution. And again, this is what they inherited from the movie. Yes, right. Of course, they could have thought of something else, too. But nevertheless, it did come from the movie first. So
it's a similar problem to the Home Alone type of string of movies.
You know,
I forget how they handled it.
I think that was more successful. Well, there's that crazy moment where they're heading to the airport, and they don't realize he's not with them. I think that do they take two cars or something like that? And then they get on the plane and they realize that he's not with them, and it takes them so long to get back that they I guess that's only vaguely more successful.
As hard as that is to believe, what is 804 times harder is Home Alone 2, where they do it again, where they forget him again. Come on, you know, fool me once, etc. You know what I mean? No, it wouldn't happen a second time. You wouldn't take your eyes off that kid.
Home Alone is the, is a masterclass in the willing suspension of disbelief and Deus Ex Machina. So.
and boy, did the nation suspend its disbelief. I mean, that was an amazing grossing picture at the time. Yeah. Amazing. So,
I think so was Big. So I guess everyone got around that this problem we've been discussing at length for the past 2 minutes.
And what's funny too is the fact that after all, film is a more realistic medium,
sure.
And musicals are far more fanciful. And to think that we're talking about whether or not a musical should get away with it, and here we are saying film, is trying to get away with it, and even in the more realistic world, it did for those two properties.
It was Home Alone ever.
Musicalized?
Musicalized or adapted for the stage? Anybody?
Give them time.
Thanks.
All right. So let's wrap up. What are you guys doing this week? Anything interesting that you should alert us to?
It's only a play for me. So I'm certainly looking forward to that. That's going to be the highlight of my week, because even though certainly there have been many reservations leveled against this property, I'm interested in seeing it because I had a wonderful time the first time I saw it in 1986. So
we will talk.
All right. We will. I reserve the right to change my mind.
I'm seeing change your mind, I don't think would even be that would be the
operative.
Yeah, because it's so different, apparently.
Okay, all right.
But anyway, I'm seeing a stage production of Deliverance. Did I mention that?
No, I know that's happening. Yeah.
That may sound insane, but I believe it's the same company where I saw a couple of years ago do a really terrific stage adaptation of 1984. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and really looking forward to that.
By the way, at Big last night was Clea Blackhurst, who is going to be doing a reading of a musical version of Hazel. And if you know that TV series that Shirley Booth starred in from way back when, I don't think you can do better than Clea Blackhurst as Hazel. I think that is ideal casting. So that's coming up with readings the week after next. And I hope that one is going to battle Something Rotten for the 2015-16 Tony.
isn't right now, this October, early November part of of the year, kind of Broadway's pilot season.
Yeah, I can see your point. I understand your point of view on that.
You know, like pilot season in Los Angeles, you know, January, February, to discover all the new things you're going to get picked up for the next year. Right now, there's so many readings and workshops and stuff like that, and it'll go all the way right before Thanksgiving, and then it'll just come to a screeching halt.
Right.
Yeah.
For 2 months.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So let me remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. There are many ways to listen to us, though. You can listen to us through many applications. One of them is Stitcher, which is an application that can stream us to your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry, so that you don't have to download and sync. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Strong enough, I am not strong enough.